This Week in Chicago History now with Anna DeVlantis, and we'll start by remembering sweetness. Good morning, Anna.
Good morning, Bob. So in the midst of what is an incredible Bears postseason, let's reflect on one of the greatest Bears of all time, because this week in Chicago history, 1988, Walter Payton had his final game with the Chicago Bears, started his career in 75 and then hung up his cleats 13 seasons later in 88. After shattering records and, you know, just capturing the heart of the city in the process. You know, we pull clips here, an interview with Sweetness when he reflected on the moment he was drafted by the Bears and said he knew nothing about Chicago, was initially kind of disappointed that he got picked by the team, and he'll explain that. But then he also talks about the time when he helped drive the Bears to their first ever Super Bowl, very memorable for Chicago, but how it was a little bit anticlimactic for him personally.
I was watching that game, the final game this week in 1988 for Walter Payton.
I was with a lot of other people.
I don't think a lot of people realize that the Harlem Globetrotters were born right here in Chicago, do they?
Yeah, it's sort of funny because the Harlem Globetrotters, you might think you're from Harlem, but they originated in Chicago and were the creation of a Chicago man. The official first game, by the way, is played this week, January 7th, 1927 was the exact date. First game was in Hinckley, Illinois, Bob, and the team members got together at the American Legion Hall, number 87 on the south side, and played a game. They also kind of played at dance halls, and it was kind of, you know, that's how it was basketball back then. You didn't have the NBA yet, and people were just getting used to the sport. So the Globetrotters were this creation of Chicago and Al Saperstein, who decided to name the team for Harlem because Harlem was the celebrated center of black culture at that time. So in the late 20s, the Globetrotters started to introduce Midwestern audiences to the sport, and in those early years, the team was pure entertainment. They were more of a real basketball team, showing off the game of basketball. They were some of the best players in the world were the Globetrotters. They won national championships. And it was interesting because the whole idea of like doing tricks and spinning balls and making all the audiences laugh with these incredible things they could do, that started by accident. The team was so good that they would start goofing off during the games, and then Al Saperstein said, hey, the audiences love that. Keep doing that. Keep doing more of that. Here's local author Mark Jacob. He was on WGN a few years back. He wrote the book about the history of the Harlem Globetrotters.
I wonder if somebody's going to do a book or a documentary on the poor Washington Generals, the team the Globetrotters always beat, remember?
It's so crazy. Yeah, I mean, you think about it, too. Like, they were such ambassadors for the sport and actually launched a few NBA athletes in the process, too. Will Chamberlain, Bob, was a Globetrotter before he became an NBA star. Cool history.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know Fergie Jenkins did a little time with the Globetrotters.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's see. It was January 11th, actually, in 2003, that George Ryan was in the news nationally, wasn't he?
Yeah, this was huge news nationally, and you'll recall this. So many listeners will, too, Bob, that on this week, 2003, then-Illinois Governor George Ryan announced he was commuting the death sentences of all 167 Illinois inmates on death row, essentially ending the death penalty in the state. Ryan didn't clear these inmates of serving prison time. He didn't free them. He commuted their sentences to life in prison without parole. The reason was too much evidence had surfaced showing that men on death row didn't commit the crimes, couldn't have committed the crimes that they were slated to be executed for. So the governor made that announcement with passion in his voice as he recalled the evidence that had been uncovered by local journalists, legal teams, and also the students at Northwestern University that had proved that these people were innocent. They couldn't have committed the crimes. One was a man named Anthony Porter, who came within 2 days of being executed before the students uncovered facts that showed he was innocent. By this point, a moratorium was already in place, so they were reviewing everything, and here was Governor Ryan, we pulled a clip, saying that the state could not in good conscience continue with executions. This was in his last few days of office in 2003.
That set quite a precedent, didn't it?
That move, such a moment in time, Bob, when people before that were not really believing that you were innocent if you were on death row, and it led to a national movement. where other states began to examine their own death rows. And in 2011, the death penalty was officially repealed in Illinois and also in many other states. So,
yeah. More This Week in Chicago History with Anna coming up momentarily. Yeah, one of Mike Royko's favorite songs. And this was the big media story in Chicago here, his move to the Trib. Anna?
Yeah, so huge, Bob, when that happened. And you're right, Mike Royko loved the blues and loved that particular album, Birth of the Blues. But this was so huge in the city. You don't really have a similar thing today. Maybe I don't know what the closest thing would be. But this week in 1984, when everyone was reading the papers and they were such a part of commuting life and life across Chicago, the Chicago Sun-Times was definitely singing the blues this day because Mike Royko made the controversial, highly publicized announcement that he was leaving the Sun-Times, where he was a star columnist, and walking across the street to the Chicago Tribune. He was a Pulitzer Prize winner at this point, respected voice. People loved his column, looked forward to reading it every day. And he was considered a voice of the working class who stuck up for the little guy and called out corruption and abuse and, you know, city leaders, including the mayor, you know, called things out the way he saw them. But Royko was done when Rupert Murdoch bought the paper. He said that, you know, he owns tabloids and I'm not going to be part of anything like that. And it felt like the independent spirit and the Chicago roots of the paper were going to be gone. And he didn't want to be part of that. So on this day, 1984, he held this news conference. He gave lots of interviews saying that he would be showing up on page 3 in the Chicago Tribune, and it was such big news. We pulled a clip here from one of the many, many interviews he gave to reporters that day.
The Sun-Times was not happy about any of that, were they?
No, it was such a jolt, and they were so concerned about their readership declining. He was such a star that they kept running old Royko columns, Bob, even after he left, as you know, just to try to say, hey, no, you know, nothing's changed over here. You know,
yeah.
You won't notice that he's gone, but of course, it was pretty obvious, and Royko went on to write for the Tribune for 13 more years until the day he died, 1997.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we noticed. This week in Chicago history, way back in 1930, WGN involved in something historic.
Yeah, huge. Huge WGN radio moment. There are so many over time. And this one is one I didn't know was connected, but was fun to kind of unearth in my research. Little Orphan Annie started as a poem, was turned into a hugely popular cartoon. And she wouldn't have been who she was without Chicago. A Chicago reporter recast her story to make Little Orphan Annie famous. And then this week, 1931, Bob, WGN radio gave her a voice, broadcasting the Little Orphan Annie radio show from the Drake Hotel in 1931. The show was sponsored by Ovaltine, and even though Annie launched it as this comic strip in 1924, now she had a voice thanks to Southsider Shirley Bell Cole, 10 years old at the time. She'd show up for her daily recordings 6 days a week and live broadcasts and all the kinds of things as a young, you know, just a young girl, 10 years old, showing up for this role. Continued it through Lakeview High School years later. And Little Orphan Annie premiered as this 15-minute show on WGN. About half the show, if you go back and listen to it, was dedicated to how delicious Ovaltine was. But there was a lot of Little Orphan Annie in there, too, Bill. But, Bob, when we pulled a clip here from the 1930s, the Little Orphan Annie radio show on WGN.
I was a Bosco guy myself. And finally, we should mention what you might call the roots of the mocktail.
Yeah, the roots of the mocktail is a good way to put it. And I didn't even realize this sort of connection either. The end of Prohibition, Bob, January 17th, 1933. But in Chicago, what's really interesting is the number of these great non-alcoholic beverages that were built basically around that moment, because people were looking for non-alcoholic legal drinks that were still really great. You know, Green River started about this time, and Dad's Root Beer did. So Dad's Root Beer founders, local Chicago guys, Eli Clapman and Barney Burns, brought this together because they even mentioned beer in the name of it, because it's like, you know, hey, let's think about, we can't have alcohol, but what can we have? They came up with a beer, like a fake beer that was brewed like beer, but it wasn't. It was Dad's Root Beer, and it just became hugely popular, a great drink to this day, and kind of cool to think about why it all started.
I have the urge for a black cow right now. Anna DeVlantis. We'll talk to you again next week.